Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. And I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So today, cultivating wonder, curiosity, and biophilia to rekin with what remains of our fauna, we are rehosting Dan Flores, author of 11 books, including Coyote America, and his most recent prodigious book, Wild New World, the epic story of animals and people in America, flora fauna from Pleistocene 66 million years ago to now, quote, deep time history of animals and humans in North America, detailing human-wildlife relations across the continent, the sixth extinction, and the odyssey of species recovery in recent decades. Elephants, giant buffalo, camels, horses, giant cats have been found with arrowheads in their bones. Humans on American continent hunting fantabulous animals 12,450 years ago and destroying our fauna kin in cruel ways, especially the last 500 years. So Br'er Rabbit joins me in welcoming Dan Flores. There was times when all the critters used to gather to sagacuate, just like there ain't been no hard times, like there ain't been no falling out, like they all remembered they were kin. Dan Flores is an American writer and historian who specializes in cultural and environmental studies of the American West. He held the A.B. Hammond Chair in Western History at the University of Montana in Missoula until he retired from that to become even more available to these projects. Welcome, Dan Flores.
It's great to be with you guys again. Thank you very much for having me.
A great pleasure. What a prodigious book. Well, and I suppose is it sort of central to your dedication that our rogue species may have manners again?
Yes, it is. I mean, I loved your introduction there with the Council of Animals all gathering. I think that's what we need to do again. We need to have another Council of Animals to decide how to proceed into the future.
Absolutely. So something that stays with me forever, when I first began living with a coyote, hosted a Lakota elder on the radio, and he said, you know, we Lakota did not hunt alone. Those gifted would go into a reverie and would negotiate a working alliance with the wolves and coyotes, and we would all hunt together for a season. And if you want to destroy the earth, make people forget this, right? So this is our radio council of all the animals that you want to bring into play. So there's so much, right? And as you said, it's big history, and the book could have been a 1,200-page book, right? There we go. Well, the whole thing is riveting, but you begin with Folsom, and maybe guide us at the beginning, the flood, the discovery of the giant bison bones with flint arrows in them.
Yeah, this is an unusual start for a book for me. I've never actually written the very first pages first of a book. I often do that towards the end of the project. But this particular one, as a result of having visited the Folsom site up in northeastern New Mexico back in 2018, sort of launched not only my thinking about how to do this book, but it stayed in place as the very beginning. And what I was writing about essentially was a time 100 years ago, a little more, 115 years ago, when we were all convinced in the United States that people hadn't been in North America for more than a couple of thousand years. Europeans already knew that they had ancestors who had interacted with mammoths and cave bears. And so Europe felt as if it had an ancient kind of human history. But in North America, we thought everything was really recent. And then this discovery at the Folsom site in the early 20th century completely changed all that. A cowboy named Charles McJunkin, after a big flood roared through that country, was out riding fence, seeing what he needed to repair on a ranch, and came upon a freshly cut chasm. And at the bottom of it, what he saw were bones of animals that he knew he had never seen before. He had actually been on the scene for the buffalo hunt in Texas 30 years before. So he knew what buffalo bones looked like, but these bones were so large, he knew it was something unusual. What they were the bones of a giant species of bison that had become extinct about 10,000 years before. And when archaeologists came in and began working that site, what they found amongst those bones were points, human-fashioned points embedded in the bones, the scapula and vertebrae of these animals, making it obvious that these were animals, extinct animals, that had been gone from America for a very long time, that had been killed by human hands. And so that launched the beginning of what became an investigation into antiquity, historical antiquity in America. I mean, we now know that people were here for certain 23,000 years ago, because we have footprints also in New Mexico, down in southern New Mexico, that have radiocarbon dated to that old. But it was only 100 years ago that we began realizing how long people had been here and interacting with animals that, of course, are no longer here, with mammoths and mastodons and saber-toothed cats and giant bison. So it was a kind of a revolution in thinking about American history. And what I tried to do with Wild New World was to start with this story, and in a single volume of fewer than 400 pages, that was the task I set to myself, I was going to tell this story from then, from the arrival of humans in America, and from the creation of the bestiary in America, going back 66 million years before, following the big asteroid strike that took out the dinosaurs, and then bring humans to the scene, and then track that story down to the present day. So that's what this book tries to do.
It's amazing. It is prodigious, right? And just things we didn't know, that the asteroid strike in the Yucatan, you said it produced tsunamis 1 mile high.
Yeah. I mean, they washed around the Gulf of Mexico, bouncing off shorelines like water in a bowl or something for months and months after this strike. I mean, it was in human times, I mean, we've been on the planet, hominins have been on the planet for about 3.5 million years. And since we've been here, there has been nothing even remotely like this Chicxulub asteroid strike 66 million years ago. I mean, it hit with such force, a 7.5 mile asteroid traveling at 27,000 miles an hour, hit with such force that it spewed ejecta beyond the gravity well of Earth. And there are some astrobiologists today who think that a hit like that on a planet that was already teeming with life may have spread microbial life, at least throughout our solar system, to not just Mars, but probably the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. So, And it set in motion then this subsequent period, that which is where I basically start the book. I start the book with the impact and then and what happens after that, which is the evolution of North American fauna and the arrival of all kinds of animals that didn't actually evolve in North America from other parts of the world, whenever there were land bridges that connected America to the rest of the planet.
Right, and you say, you know, our term Anthropocene needs to be pushed back further. You say looking further back in time than the Neolithic, and just a little, you know, everything talking to us, right? There is the comet Green, right, has not been seen on Earth since Neolithic, right, and it's back, and its closest approach to the Earth will be February 2nd, so it's a little, you know, kind of a comet postcard from the Neolithic going, hello, to join your book, right? So,
yes, it is. So my point about the Anthropocene stretching back much farther in time than we think. I mean, we call what's going on around us the sixth extinction. And the one I just described, by the way, the asteroid impact 66 million years ago, was the fifth extinction. So what we're calling the sixth extinction is what we see happening around us, which is the loss of, I mean, some biologists are arguing possibly we may lose a third of all life on Earth if worst-case scenarios come to play. But what I argue in this book is that we have to sort of rethink what the Anthropocene really is, because it's pretty evident that as humans perfected our carnivorous predatory lifestyle and began moving out of Africa into parts of the world where animals had never confronted human predators before and were completely naive about us, we had a prodigious effect on wild creatures all over Europe, Asia, and ultimately the Americas. I mean, there was a piece in a very august journal in 2018 arguing that in that spread out of Africa and around the world, we took out some 300 mammal species and more than 2.5 billion years of distinctively evolved genetics vanished as a result of this migration that humans made starting about 40,000 years ago around the planet. So the Anthropocene, if we're really interested in trying to define that as the time when humans began to really exert a large influence on the Earth, I mean, it begins much earlier than we thought. We tended to think that it started with the beginning of the fossil fuel age and or the nuclear age or something like that. But I argue in Wild and World that it probably goes back somewhere between 25 and 40,000 years ago when humans were doing these migrations and taking out so many of these charismatic, very long-lived ancient creatures that we don't have with us anymore.
Right. And you mentioned that, you know, two books that were useful compos to you, Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, and then E.O. Wilson and Biophilia and the Love of Diverse Life. And then I guess his last book before he departed us, Half Earth, right? Do you have some desire? Is Half Earth, you know, like, are you up for that?
Well, I think, you know, what I really use most of Wilson's in this particular book is the biophilia one, because I think he is absolutely correct that there is for certain an intrinsic love of other life forms on the part of humans. I think our fascination with animals at every level, from our pets to creatures that we see on PBS to the animals that we interact with in our daily lives, when we get to see coyotes, for example, in the park, or we get to see flocks of birds migrating. I mean, that kind of feeling that we have about other living creatures on Earth is, I think Wilson's right, a very ancient kind of thing. The issue, of course, has been that we've sometimes let other particular ideologies override that ancient love of other life and other creatures. And a lot of Wild New World is sort of tracks those dual sentiments in humans. I mean, I track, for example, the biophilia impulse when 500 years ago, 400 years ago, when Europeans are arriving in considerable numbers into North America, many old world naturalists are going to be completely fascinated by what they're seeing in America because, for one thing, the books that they're relying on, particularly the Holy Book, the Bible, doesn't posit that there's anything like America, and certainly the so-called great chain of being that goes back to the Greeks that sort of laid out all the animals on Earth with humans on top, it had no inkling about all the creatures that existed in North America. And so these naturalists, I mean, you know, probably the most prominent one in American history is John James Audubon. I mean, they are utterly fascinated with the life that they see here. And so they're indulging, I think, in this biophilia impulse. I think when we try to return species that are endangered or threatened under the Endangered Species Act, we're indulging in this old E.O. Wilson idea of biophilia. But as I said, one of the things that tracks through our story is that there are other ideologies that are competing with this ancient love of other life forms, and sometimes those other ideologies override that old biophilia impulse.
Right, because your teammates, you know, Ben Goldfarb and Lila Phillips, and I've hosted them on Beavers, right, and so many of the great fortunes, like the Astor fortune, came from Beaver slaughter, and we go, oh, that's it. And then just to go backwards and forwards and wherever you want to go, you talk about the Predator Guild, and that the idea of an afterlife occurred to humans as remorse, right, for what they'd been doing. And then you mention one of my favorite films that I often talk, you go, Francis Chauvet gave The Cave of Forgotten Dreams. You say 34,000 years ago, the artist was a Paleolithic Picasso. And then this word I had not heard before, therianthrope. Is that humans and animals? Right. Describe what therianthrope is.
Yes, and it's there is a therianthrope in Chauvet Cave, a very famous one. And those of your listeners who have access to that film can see it. In that case, it's a creature represented as a bison and a human female, all as one creature. And as the cameras in Cave of Forgotten Dreams sort of rotate around this pillar that this image is on, in some views, the creature looks more like a human, and in other views, it looks more like an animal. But it's clearly a combination of the two. And I think those kinds of images where humans and other animals are joined together are of a sort of wonderfully widespread and ancient kind of projection down to us today from the ancient past of how people used to consider other creatures. And I think that, at least the way I track it in Wild New World, where you really see it in America, see this idea expressed probably best of all, is in that 10,000-year period after the Pleistocene is over and all the extinctions of the big charismatic animals are done. But there's a 10,000-year period of Native America before Europeans, Old Worlders, began arriving here, when Native people are able to live in America for that long with only one extinction credited to them, and it's a flightless shoreline sea duck. Flightless birds, of course, are usually the first things that go when humans arrive anywhere, and there was a flightless duck on the Pacific coast that did become extinct in that period, but otherwise we don't have any evidence of any other extinctions, and I argue for several reasons for that, but one of the most important ones that link to this idea of a therianthrope is this conviction, a philosophical conviction that Native people have, that they are kin to other creatures, and they can actually travel between human societies and animal societies, so that many of the ceremonies that they do feature these kind of faux marriages between humans and other animals. And the idea of this kinship is to convey to other creatures the tremendous respect that humans have for them, that we don't simply regard them as something put on earth for us to use. We regard them as fellow kin, and not only kin, but kin in a therianthrope sense, where we can actually transition from one society to another. And that sort of philosophical thinking, I think, is probably key to how Native people are able to preserve the biological diversity of America for so long. And it stands in pretty marked contrast to what Old Worlders bring to America when they arrive, because they've absorbed a religious tradition that has taught Europeans, that humans are exceptional. Humans are the only creatures made in the image of a deity, in the image of God, the only ones that have souls, and as the Old Testament puts it in the book of Genesis, Unto your hand are all other creatures delivered. They are all here basically for humans to use. And so when the old world ideas that accompany the colonists to America in the 1600s began arriving, there is a completely different kind of relationship between human beings and animals. And I mean, one of the things I try to point out, because it strikes me as a stunning thing to know, is that there were animals like, for example, passenger pigeons, the most numerous bird species in America. In fact, it was the most numerous bird, single bird species in the world. They had been in America for 15 million years. And as soon as old worlders arrive in the 1600s, passenger pigeons are not able to last even 300 years. They can't survive 300 years of the arrival of a population of people with a completely different sort of mindset about the relationship between humans and other animals. Go ahead.
You go. I didn't mean to cut you off. Yeah.
I was basically coming to the conclusion of that. I was just going to say, sort of in summation, is that after the first three or so chapters, which are all about deep time, going back to the Chicxulub impact and the Clovis period and the Folsom period, and then the third chapter is about this 10,000-year Native America period, starting in chapter four in Wild New World, that's where I pick up this dual story of old worlders arriving with, as I said a few minutes ago, a group of naturalists who are fascinated, Mark Catesby, William Bartram, John Lawson, a whole slew of them, who are really fascinated with these New World creatures and are writing these wonderful natural history essays about them and trying to discover as many of them as possible. And at the same time, there is what you referenced with Lila Phillip and Ben Goldfarb's books about beavers. At the same time, there's this old world tradition arriving of animals are here for us to use. We are, after all, driven by a market economy. And in this market economy, animals of all kinds, not just beavers, but white-tailed deer and sea otters and passenger pigeons and bison and on and on and on, all of these are basically just commodities in a global market. And so the idea is anybody can go out and make themselves a fortune, rise into the middle class or the upper class, as John Jacob Astor did, by killing America's animals. And we have 300 years of this going without any kind of break on it whatsoever. Colonial governments, state governments, the federal government really doesn't even try to control any of this. They just let it happen, at least not until 1900. Does the federal government even play any kind of role in all this? And these smaller governments aren't able to do a single thing about it. And so the result is the United States in this period, the American from the colonial period up to about 1920 or so, engages in the largest destruction of wild creatures that's discoverable anywhere in modern world history. It's one of the things most Americans don't know about our country, but it's unfortunately one of the truths about it.
So yeah, there's richness in every sentence you offer us in wildlife, Wild New World. So yeah, there's also the Carolina parakeet, which you said was a foot long, and multicolored and incredibly beautiful, and it's like gone.
Yeah, most of us today, I mean, we look around the world, we think that everything is normal, I mean, which is kind of part of the human condition. In order to keep your happiness set point up, you look around the world and things seem to be fine. And one of the reasons I wrote this book is not to bring people down, but I wanted us to understand that in the process of creating the best country on earth, as we've always called it, we did some things that really changed the possibility of what kind of a life one leads in the modern world. And one of the reasons I was so fascinated in this book by passenger pigeons and Carolina parakeets is I'm a native of Louisiana. Both of those species were present in Louisiana. Passenger pigeons, of course, were found all the way up into Canada. And Carolina parakeets, our only tropical native parrot, they were actually found all the way into New York State. I mean, they were found on the Hudson River. So these birds spread from the south all the way across the eastern United States, and they were part of this tremendous bio-richness that Europeans found when they arrived here and took America from its native owners. And as I said, none of these species is able to last more than two or three or four centuries. Carolina parakeets are gone by the 1930s, two subspecies of them, an eastern seaboard one and one that ranged, subspecies that ranged all the way out into Colorado and Nebraska. And they were both gone by the 1930s. And so what's striking to me about it, having grown up in a place where my grandparents were alive when passenger pigeons were still flying through the skies in Louisiana, and Carolina parakeets were still in their beautiful flocks doing these the way parrots do, like feathered gymnasts in trees, doing all these pirouettes and flying as kind of colorful, almost exotic tropical blankets of birds through the forest. My grandparents got to see that, and I'm never going to get to see it myself. I mean, I've experienced what I write about in the book Henry David Thoreau described in 1850s Massachusetts. I mean, he had been reading about all the creatures that had been in Massachusetts when the Puritans had arrived and realized that half those were gone from his world in the 1850s. And Thoreau wrote this wonderful journal entry where he says, you know, it's like looking up into the sky at night and realizing that some demigod has come along before you ever arrived and plucked the best of the stars and the best of the constellations out of the sky, and you're never going to get to see them. And he ended that journal passage with this incredible line. He said, you know, I wish to know an entire heaven and an entire earth. But he realized he was never going to get to do that because of the selfishness of human generations that had gone before him.
Selfishness, cruelty, and greed. Oh, my. Yes, all of that. And then I just want to bring up just a brief thing back to Cave of Forgotten Dreams, because it travels with us. So I love that it was Werner Herzog, right? Grumpy guy, perfect, because he didn't come in with any preconceived ideas. And there's a fantastic horse, right, 34,000 years ago. And 5,000 years later, somebody paints another horse. And there's all these flutes made of 34,000-year-old antler. And there's a fire pit. And there's a moment where we can see Herzog seeing it. I think he even closes his eyes. And he goes, so people gathered here for over 5,000 years. They played music. And they shadow danced between the fire pit with the paintings, with the animals and the therianthropes, the animals becoming humans and humans becoming animals. I love that. And it's like, you know, everything that you're delineating and the enormous loss and Thoreau and we're going to take a very short break in a moment, but we'll get to the surprising contribution of Richard Nixon. Well, many things all over the place. Yeah, I love that. So the ancients had flip books and movies, thank you very much. But it reminds us that the purpose of art was not even to be seen. It was a collaborative kinship dance ritual. It's such a useful movie. So our guest today is Dan Flores. His prodigious book, We Gotta Know It, Wild New World, The Epic Story of Animals and People in America, is fantastic. And we're going to take a very short musical break, and we will be right back. Here we go.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Ooh, chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our fantastic guest, Dan Flores, written 11 books, Coyote America, but his latest, Wild New World, the epic story of animals and people in America, from 66 million years ago to now, is, I can't recommend it highly enough. So, yes, well, many ways we want to go. There's so much in the book, but at some point, I can't remember who, you'll have to help me, but good to make prayers to Raven. Here we are in the Ravens and Coyotes in America, 75 times longer than the U.S. has existed have been Ravens and Coyotes here. But yeah. Who is it who says it's good to make prayers to Raven?
Richard Nelson. I mean, and he's writing about the Koyukon people. His book is about the Koyukon people of Alaska and the subarctic. And the section that you're referring to is where I describe how the Koyukon people perceive the relationship that they have with other creatures. And the mediating creature in the world, for them, it's not coyote. Coyote doesn't live that far north at the time that they're developing their particular philosophy. It's Raven, and Raven is this, and interestingly, one just flew by my window as I said
oh,
that.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
I think we've been graced by one of my local ravens here in Santa Fe. But the raven as deity story, I think, is typical. The reason I tell it is because it's typical of these oldest deities in North American history. It's like the only truly ancient Paleolithic figures who we know the names of in North American history are the deities. I mean, we don't have any good histories that give us from 10,000 years ago what the name of a particular chieftain or shaman or civil leader might have been. Some famous woman. We don't have that. What we do have are the names of the deities. And I call that chapter Ravens and Coyotes America, and it's that 10,000-year period I was mentioning earlier where Native people basically have North America to themselves. And it's kind of a fascinating story. I had not seen, when I began working on it, anyone exactly try to track what I was attempting to track, which was the relationship between people and the animals around them. So it took quite a bit of work to try to put that together, and those make prayers to the Raven stories, that's one way I try to do it.
And Raven is concerned that there are too many humans. So I don't know if you know this piece, and is it okay if I read you a short thing by William Kittredge on Raven? Is that fine with you?
You know, Bill Kittredge was a great friend of mine when I was at the University of Montana. Yeah, he was, and I have spent many an hour with Bill and our buddy, his really dear friend, Jim Crumley, sitting on the porch of Bill and Onyx Smith's ranch out in the Blackfoot Valley. And so, yeah, please read something by Bill.
All right. Well, you probably know it, but it's one of my favorite things ever in the world. He's talking about a raven rattle from the Tsimshian Indians. And he says it's a percussive musical instrument used in elaborate ceremonial dances, a simple rattle like the ones we all shook in childhood, except that this one is carved in the form of a mythological raven caught in the act of stealing the sun back from captivity, carrying the little red ball of the sun in his mouth, preparing to spit it home into the heavens again. That's a striking idea, but not half so remarkable as the beings we see riding on the raven, a human figure reclining back in a posture of sexual openness, and a frog crouching over as if preparing to mount, and their tongues, or tongue, red and slender and arcing, it's a single tongue and a most remarkable thing as it reaches from human to frog and frog to human. It's all the same in this vision, in which we share tongues with the animals in some perfect sexuality, while our trickster raven redeploys the sun, as in Raven Brought the Light. The unknown person who made that rattle is a glory to our species. See, that raven rattle says, this is how we are, inextricably one with everything, however tricked, riding in fact on the back of trickiness itself. I just love that.
So what it obviously is conveying, and what that raven rattle is conveying, is the therianthropic kinship idea.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm delighted that Bill, I actually had not heard that. I've heard him read all kinds of things, but I hadn't heard that particular one, so that's a delight to hear.
It's so wonderful, writing, in fact, on the back of trickiness itself, because, you know, everything that you write, and it is just prodigiously researched and offered to us in such a great thing, again, Wild New World by Dan Flores, but we know we have endogenous receptors, right, in us for, like, cannabis and DMT, but I think we have endogenous receptors for kinship. You know, and they might have gotten numbed, but works such as you're offering, all of your books really, but Wild New World, it's like there's a part of us that goes, and as you mentioned, you know, many of the stories are hard. The incredible cruelty to wolves and coyotes and the poisoning, and I mean, all the things that we want to touch on, going, humans, you know, but then this yearning for kinship, and you do make the point. Well, there's so many points, but that it's not just. I mean, Europeans are egregious, but you say that, you know, before that, you know, native people were killing 100,000, you know, white-tailed deer a year for market, right? So presumably it's the whites who bring the rapacious European market, but everybody's killing like crazy, right?
Yeah, they are. I mean, what happens, of course, is that native people get snagged by the market economy, because
right.
What happens when Europeans arrive is that they're arriving with an iron steel technology, and offering native people who are still using flint tools something like an iron or steel sword or a knife or a hatchet or a hoe or a rake, all those technological possibilities for bettering their lives, not just gratuitously, but significantly, it leads them inevitably into, so what do you Europeans want for that technology? And what the Europeans want are the parts of animals. They want the skins of beavers and the skins of sea otters, and they want white-tailed deer pelts to use as leather and for the leather trade back in the old world. And so what native people do is the logical human thing in order to not be left behind, because if you refuse to engage the new technology, your neighbors down the river probably aren't going to, and that's going to end up just disadvantaging you if you pass it up. So what native people do is they get snagged by the market economy, and they, throughout the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, they're part of the labor force in killing animals for the global market. I mean, sometimes I tell the stories of some groups, for example, on the Pacific coast, who end up getting kidnapped and forced to play a role in the market, forced to hunt sea otters and fur seals and things for the Russians and for the Brits and for the Americans. But for a lot of people, you know, one of the stories I tell in the book is about growing up in Louisiana. I talk a fair amount about what I experienced growing up in Louisiana in the 1960s in a place that had been depopulated of so many animals. And one of the stories I found when I went to college was about a native family that 200 years before me, 150 years before me, had in one fall season killed 400 white-tailed deer and 118 black bears for the market. And what I related was the result down the timeline is that I grew up in a Louisiana where I never saw a black bear. I mean, I grew up near a river that the French had named the River of Bears, but there were no bears on it when I was a kid. There were almost no deer left, although deer were being restocked and were coming back. But, I mean, I experienced a world sort of like Thoreau's world in 1850s Massachusetts, where some demigod had come before me and wiped out all the grandest things in nature. I mean, I never saw, as a kid, growing up on the banks of the Black Bayou in Caddo Parish, Louisiana, I never saw an alligator nor heard an alligator roar because alligators had been almost completely exterminated in Louisiana for their skins. So this is a kind of an experience, I guess, for a lot of modern Americans who don't understand this story that they maybe can't relate to, although if for the people who are paying attention, the reason we're having to go through the whole process of recovering wolves in America is because prior generations of Americans bringing this old world herder idea with its hatred of predators over here launched the crusade to wipe wolves and coyotes and almost all predators off the face of North America from the time they stepped foot on shore. First environmental act ever passed in North America by Europeans was a bounty on wolves in 1628 Massachusetts. So it's for people who read this book, there are going to be sections of it that are going to sound like an elegy because, I mean, one dramatic species after another, our northern hemisphere penguins, the great auks, are extinct by the 1840s. Passenger pigeons are extinct by the early 1900s. Carolina parakeets are extinct by the 1930s. We've, for the first time, declared ivory-billed woodpeckers extinct in the 1930s. Only 16 whooping cranes left in 1936. Trumpeter swans. I mean, that story happens again and again. But as you know, having read the book, this book actually ends up as a kind of an optimistic take on where we finally arrive over the last 50 or so years. I mean, what it really conveys is that at some point in the 20th century, Americans began to wake up to what they were sacrificing and stopped just sort of walking cluelessly as if they were sleepwalking through the world and finally began paying attention to what was going on. And so the last 50, 60 or so years, we've done a lot better.
Right. No. We want to end up with our allying ourselves with Trickster and Raven and Coyote and that resilient against all odds prodigious comeback as the beavers have come back and a little bit of buffalo come back. But you end the Clovisia chapter by saying, what lesson do we humans 13,000 years down the timeline draw from Clovisia the Beautiful? You say the whole planet is still holding its breath to know. Right? So you're always pitching it to us. But who remind me, it's somewhere in my notes here, you know, but who was it who had the dream, the Native American person who had the dream going, oh, there's going to be coming these strange people, you know, white people, and they're going to have these long sticks that they point at creatures. Who was that? Remind me.
It was an Ojibwa shaman.
Thank you.
whose dream story has been preserved for us. And it's the way I open the chapter on the arrival of Europeans to North America is, I think I say something like, you know, how would you react to, after 10,000 years, your world suddenly being completely transformed almost overnight? And I go on to say, perhaps what you do is you dream it. And that allows me to talk about this particular dream that we have preserved in the historical record by this Ojibwa shaman in the Great Lakes, who has a dream before anyone, any native people have seen Europeans. He has a dream that giant canoes are landing somewhere along the shore of the Great Water to the east, and that the people who are in them have pale, bushy faces and are holding long black tubes that they point at birds and animals, and a huge cloud of smoke erupts from the tubes, and a sound, he said, that is so gigantic that it awakened him from the dream when he heard these tubes explode. And so he relates this to the particular group, the band that he's living with, and I use that as the entree for the arrival of Europeans, and their sort of immediate reaction to seeing the wildlife riches of America, which are going to become ever more abundant as the result of Europeans. I mean, this is not an intentional thing Europeans do, but they, of course, are arriving with old world diseases that had come about because old worlders, Euro-Asians, had been domesticating animals for 7,000 or 8,000 years. And, of course, as we all know from COVID, the most common way for humans to get new diseases is through a kind of a jumping factor from animals into human beings. It's one way we express our kinship with other creatures, is that we're susceptible to their diseases. So these Europeans are going to arrive with all these diseases that have jumped from animals into humans. And, of course, as COVID has done, they've evolved and they've changed, and they've wiped out the susceptible but left people who seem to be fairly resistant to them, but they still survive as diseases that Europeans are going to infect native people with. And as I describe in the book, when that happens, we think that the native population just before Europeans arrive in what is now the United States and Canada was probably just shy of about 5 million people. And those disease epidemics knocked the population down to fewer than a million, about 900,000 people. And when 80% of the human population in the interior disappears, that allows animals to go through a huge ecological release. And so one of the reasons that Europeans are so giddy over the numbers of passenger pigeons and beavers and white-tailed deer is because those animals have been released into a kind of population explosion as a result of the deaths, the great dying of 80% or so of the native population in the Americas. So it's, you know, there are stories like that. I mean, when you have 66 right. million years to work with, you've got a lot of possibility for stories. So there are a huge number of stories like that in the book.
Right, there are. Again, the book is Wild New World, The Epic Story of Animals and People in America by Dan Flores. I cannot recommend it highly enough. And then you mentioned spillover. There's a great book called Spillover, the term for when viruses leap species. And the scientists I'm sorry, say what?
David Quammen's book, yeah.
Thank you. Right, and they just say flat out, the scientists say, here's just a fact to put on our work table. Ecological disturbance causes diseases to emerge. There we have it. You know, the pandemic will not end until humans quit despoiling the earth. And then I just want to bring up one other, the quirky historic thing, right, where the Aztecs mistake Cortez for Quetzalcoatl. And this is because you know, the Venus orbital cycle is the Quetzalcoatl myth, and Venus will be close to the sun, not visible, and then will, having been the evening star, will disappear, and then will rise, the heliacal rise, as the morning star when Venus returns as Quetzalcoatl. And in some terrible thing, right, Cortez arrives at that moment, right, at the heliacal rise of Venus, and they mistake him. We can just put always a problem to mistake a human for a mythological figure. And just one other little thing, and I'll hand it back to you. But I was at the Republican convention as part of Pacifica's coverage, and when Trump was nominated, it was the heliacal rise of Venus, right? So these myths live in us, and it's like, oh, it's Trump, it's Quetzalcoatl. It's like, no, it's a human. But the rituals live in us, even if we don't know them, right? I mean, so, and that same mistake, so I just wanted to stick that one in there, too.
I would just add to that what you're referencing there from that particular story in the book is what I call first contact, which is it's treated several different times in the book in different forms. There's biological first contact when other animals are confronting human predators for the first time and not understanding that humans are dangerous. There's first contact between cultures like what you just described where, I mean, the only way, the theory of first contact argues this, the only way you can understand somebody completely new who appears in front of you is through what's already in your head. I mean, eventually you'll come to some new and more realistic understanding of new arrivals, but when Europeans and native people confront one another for the first time, the only way they can do it at the beginning is through what's already in their heads, and that's where the story you just told about Quetzalcoatl comes into play. And from the European side, what's in their heads about native people is that Europeans come from a 7,000 or 8,000 year tradition of Christianity having overrun and overwhelmed paganism in the old world. And they see native people in America who don't know anything about Jesus, who don't know anything about a God in the sky, who are completely innocent of these old world ideas. Their conclusion is, these people must be like the pagans we defeated thousands of years ago, who actually were devil worshipers. And so it preloads the whole kind of relationship between these early Europeans and native people. For native people to be imagining Europeans as one thing and Europeans with a completely different take on who native people are.
And then as we are moving into our uplift, our uplift ending in a way, there's so many remarkable things. Like you quote Richard Nixon, and I don't know if you have it in front of you, I do, but he says, this is the environmental awakening. It marks a new sensitivity of the American spirit and a new maturity of American public life. It's working a revolution in values. Wild things constitute a treasure to be protected and cherished for all time. The wonder, beauty, and elemental force in which the least of them share suggests a higher right to exist, not granted to them by man and not his to take away. That was Nixon.
It's Nixon. Right? Yeah, I can almost guarantee if one read that quote, that passage on the radio or on television, on MSNBC or CNN, and ask viewers to identify who the speaker was, Richard Nixon would be somewhere down in the lower hundreds as a possibility. But that is a Richard Nixon speech from 1972, written by his speechwriter, Russell Train, who was an environmentalist, a Republican environmentalist. But what Nixon was doing was essentially setting up the passage the following year of the Endangered Species Act of 1973, which is going to put into place what I argue in Wild New World, and I'm convinced this is true. It puts into place 50 years ago this year probably one of the two or three most important pieces of legislation and best ideas Americans have ever come up with. You know, Ken Burns argues that the national parks are America's best idea. I would say that the Endangered Species Act ranks right up there with the national parks, or the Declaration of Independence and its lofty language written by Thomas Jefferson, because it expands the circle of ethical treatment beyond humans to other creatures and concedes a really important premise. Other creatures have the right to exist on the earth. That's really important.
That's great. No, and even just your bringing that quote to our attention reminds us of one of your sacramental ways of participating in the world, which is nuance and complexity. No person is one thing, and with Russell Train writing a speech, but there's Richard Nixon doing, you know, a great contribution. Thank you for that part. Yeah, extraordinary. And then you know, here we are on our way out. I'm surrounded by notes we haven't even gotten to. You great prodigious being. Wild New World: The Epic Story of Animals and People in America. You do carry a talisman in your pocket, right? You have a replica of the Folsom Point, and maybe we'll just, you know, end our last minute here. If you just want to, because it's in your pocket, a great and referenced a great deal for the book. So is it in your pocket now?
It's not in my pocket, but it's only 10 feet away. It's only just 10 feet away. Yes, I have a replica bronze Folsom Point that an artist friend made for me probably 25 years ago that I have had ever since, and I keep close by because it helps propel me as a kind of a talisman in my hand and in my pocket towards where this book goes in its last two or three pages, where in the epilogue, which is about our present condition in America and on planet Earth and the looming doom of climate change and what that's doing to other species and on and on. But where I go at the very end of the book is to sort of confront that Thoreau dilemma of, am I going to submit to the anguish of being that citizen whom I pity, as he called himself, or am I going to do something else? I can't really, at this stage of the game, do anything about the fact that I'm not going to ever see a passenger pigeon or a Carolina parakeet.
We're on our way out, but let me give you a short sentence rather than mourn, be intimate. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I do, is I say I'm going to experience what's left while I have the time to do so, with every fiber of my being, and I describe how I do.
We're out of here all too soon. Thank you so much, Dan Flores, for your latest book, Wild New World, The Epic Story of Animals and People in America. Wonderful. Thank you, Dan Flores, and thank you always, Kirsten Thomas. I'm Caroline Casey, and we will reconvene next week. Thank you, team.